Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Flora Soflo welcoming you to Monday Memos from Concordia Seminary. It is my privilege, on behalf of the faculty, Board of Control, and students of the seminary, to wish each of you a truly happy and blessed new year, a year filled with God's gift of love and kindness, of confidence in the knowledge that He is guiding and leading us throughout the new year just begun, and His promise that He never leaves us nor forsakes us. We have as our guest today an individual who has been at the seminary for a number of years now, but this is the first time he has appeared on this program. It's a pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Robert Herber, member of the faculty. Welcome, Dr. Herber.
I am happy to have the privilege of being here with you before our KFUO radio audience. In March, I will have completed 7 years at the seminary, plus some previous part-time service as teacher in the graduate school from 1958 through 1960.
You mean it's 7 years since you've been here? It doesn't really seem that long. However, I remember very well how much you came to the rescue here in the winter of 1974, not only in the classroom, but also in a number of other areas. Actually, I think there wasn't anything that you didn't do during those days. And in a way, I think that hasn't changed a whole lot. You're still wearing many different hats. But before we go into that, let's start with you. Before coming here, you were on the faculty of Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri for 27 years, was it?
That's correct.
What was your area of specialization there?
Well, Westminster, let me begin by saying, is a liberal arts college of between 600 and 700 students. Only male students were admitted until last year.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know that.
Yes, this seems strange when I get back on campus now and see some women, a limited number of women walking around the building. In fact, up until that time, Westminster was the only all-men liberal arts college under Protestant auspices west of the Mississippi.
I see.
My position was professor of Greek and Latin. I started there in 1947 and taught there almost continuously until I came to the seminary in 1974. As professor of Greek and Latin, I naturally taught the courses in those two languages, and I gave electives in the history department under two courses entitled Greek Civilization, Roman Civilization. Furthermore, the English department asked me to assist by teaching a course in mythology. At times, I would have 40 students in a civilization course and up to 80 in a course in mythology.
Wow, that's a lot of people in one course, isn't it?
It is. Then we had a unique program there. It began, about 5 years before I left, a humanities sequence. And in the first semester, which dealt with the early period of the Egyptians and the Hebrews and the Greeks and the Romans, then I and four other colleagues, one in history, one in philosophy, one in English, would get together. We have 125 students. Each of us would give two or three lectures, and then we would meet the class in small groups of 20 each for discussion. My work in Greek was primarily with pre-ministerial students. These students were obligated to take 2 years of any foreign language. Since they planned to go into the ministry, I could count on them being in my Greek class for 2 years. These students then went to such seminaries as Harvard Divinity School, Princeton Theological Seminary, Southern Methodist University, McCormick in Chicago, Louisville Seminary, and at times, after having, in some cases, 4 years of Greek, they would then be assigned to teach the Greek class at these seminaries.
I see. Well, that sounds to me like you had a very diversified program already at that time. I noticed that you were listed at Fulton as a distinguished service professor. What does that mean? Could you explain that?
Yes, this was a special rank limited to three professors at one time. Those of us who happen to have particularly long tenure and special service to the college. I really can't say why I was chosen. Possibly it was because my class load, or at least the student load, was small enough so that I could arrange my program to do quite a bit of scholarly work and publication, which of course is appreciated at any school.
Mm-hmm. At any rate, it was a distinct title.
That's correct,
yeah.
Yes. And incidentally, it did pay me an additional $1,000 per year.
Well, that wasn't too hard to take either. Early in your ministry, Dr. Herber, you also served on the faculty of Bethany College in Mankato, Minnesota, and I think at St. Olaf's College in Northfield, Minnesota. Is that correct?
That's correct. In fact, after finishing the seminary in 1944, my first call was to Mankato, Minnesota. Bethany Lutheran College was similar to our prep schools in the Missouri Synod, 4 years of high school, 2 years of junior college. This school was run by the Norwegian Synod. At that time, you recall, the Wisconsin Synod, the small Norwegian Synod, and the Missouri Synod with the Slovak Synod formed the Synodical Conference. Mm-hmm. About five of us from the Missouri Synod were teaching there while I was there. And it might be to our audience to note that two of my present colleagues, Dr. Klotz and Dr. Fremder, were also with me when I was there at Bethany College.
Is that right? Well, I was not aware of that.
So it seems like old times getting back together with them
right,
again.
Yeah.
Then in 1965, I was appointed chairman of the Department of Classical Languages at St. Olaf College. It was really a fine experience. St. Olaf had at that time 2,500 students, a faculty of 135. St. Olaf belonged to the American Lutheran Church. It was the college of the Norwegians, and I would say it's one of the best, if not the best, Lutheran college in the country, mm-hmm. with very excellent academic high standards and extremely high moral character among the students. There, of course, I also taught the Greek and Latin, and from having maybe five in a Greek class at Westminster, immediately I had 38 to 44 in a Greek class there. I stayed there for 2 years, and of course, I suppose your next question would be, why didn't I stay there continuously? I suppose the explanation is one word, geography. Being so far from St. Louis, where I had a widowed mother and sister whom I thought should be closer to where I was living, or at least I should be closer to where they were living. And at the time when I was contemplating that, Westminster made me an offer to return, so that I returned there after 2 years of service at St. Olaf. But I must say that it was very, very enjoyable service.
Mm-hmm. Well, undoubtedly, you know a great many of the St. Louis people since, as you already mentioned, you were born here. You attended St. John's Lutheran School, and after finishing prep school at St. John's in Winfield, you studied here at our seminary and graduated in 1944. Am I correct that while you were a student here, you also studied at Washington U, and in fact, received your master's degree 2 years before you graduated here?
That is correct.
How did you do that?
Well, it was, again, a combination of circumstances. After finishing St. John's College in Winfield, I was offered a scholarship at the University of Chicago, where I attended during the year of 1938 to 39. Then I matriculated at the seminary, and at that time, all of my classes were in the morning. So I would spend my afternoons at Washington University Library taking a seminar each semester, plus at least two courses during the summer. So sort of unexpectedly, by the time I was ready for vicarage in 1942, I was awarded the master's degree.
Wow.
Then I was fortunate enough to receive a graduate fellowship to continue work for the doctorate degree, which I did for my 2 years of vicarage. So mm-hmm. in fact, I had received my doctorate degree in Greek and Latin in May of 44, and I still had one more year left to finish at the seminary. At that time, it was during the Second World War. We had classes during the summer, and I again enrolled here during the summer, and at that time I received my call to Bethany.
Well, that's most interesting. So you left here with a PhD under your belt, huh?
That's right.
We better keep moving here. Your wife is the former Ruth Hanser, niece of our dear friend Dr. Theodore Hanser, and I don't think there's anyone here in St. Louis who does not know him. And you have one son, Robert Jr., who I think is almost as interesting and colorful as his father. Can you tell us just a little bit about him? We don't have a whole lot of time, but just a little.
Our son finished Westminster in 1975, and then after 2 years of graduate work at the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri, he received his MBA, Master of Business Administration. Then he was employed at Westminster for the first year in the Development Department. An opening developed in the Economics Department, so he is now in his third year of teaching, or his fourth year of service at Westminster. It makes it very convenient for him to be in Fulton. He's living in our home in Fulton, so it's a good place for us to go and relax about one weekend each month.
Right, that's great. Now, I mentioned earlier that you wear many hats around here, so let's talk about some of them. You're listed in our catalog as Acting Director of Academic Programs. That sounds like a big order. What does it cover?
Well, it covers, Gladys, really nine different areas. First, it covers each of the four departments: Department of Exegetical Theology, Department of Historical Theology, Department of Practical Theology, and Systematic Theology. In a few moments, we may go into those definitions a little bit more at length. In addition to those four departments, we have in our area the School for Graduate Studies, which offers both the Master of Sacred Theology and the PhD. The continuing education area, which includes our correspondence school, the library, which is, of course, one of the best theological libraries in the country, the area of the registrar, who has charge of the records of the students, receives and sends out transcripts and records grades, and finally, the World Mission Institute, a five-man committee which is interested not only in foreign missions, but ministry to the deaf and minority groups.
That really doesn't leave much else, does it?
Not much.
Okay. In this connection, maybe it's a little bit far-fetched right here, but people have sometimes asked, what about the curriculum for our students? Who decides what courses must be taken before a student can graduate here? And what are these courses? Can you tell us something about that?
Surely. The curriculum, of course, is in the hands of the faculty, with naturally the approval of the Board of Control. We emphasize here what we call the classical theological curriculum. We have divided all the courses into four departments: the exegetical department, which concerns the scripture per se in the original languages; the historical department, for example, studying the early church, the Reformation; the practical department, which would be the courses in worship and preaching; and the systematic department, which studies the doctrines from a topical point of view, one section on the doctrine of God, another section on the doctrine of Christ, justification, and so forth. So mm-hmm. our students are required to take a certain number of hours in each of these departments, plus six electives over their career here. And between the second and third year, they spend a year of vicarage, as sort of as a journeyman in the old country, under mm-hmm. the tutelage of a pastor in a congregation. Plus, of course, they must do field work in our local churches part-time during their first 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned six electives. Can these be in any one department?
In any one department,
oh,
that's
uh-huh.
right. Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
So if a student happens to have a particular interest, say in history, he may fulfill his required courses of 18 hours and then take all six electives
I
in further
see.
History courses.
Uh-huh, yeah. Okay, you're also chairman of the editorial committee of the Concordia Journal. And the journal, of course, is the official publication put out by our seminary every other month. Give us a little background and history about the journal. I think, if I'm not mistaken, the predecessor of this magazine was the CTM, Concordia Theological Monthly, and before that, Larry and Leary. Is that correct?
That's correct. When we had the reorganization in 1974, Dr. Charlemagne, the acting president, with Dr. Klan, decided then and there that we must have our own theological journal.
Now, I think it's interesting that that decision was made rather quickly.
Very, very soon, that's
yeah.
right.
Mm-hmm.
The first volume was printed and sent out in 1975. It consisted of 4 issues. Beginning the following year, we went to 6 issues per year. So now we have just finished, in volume 1980, volume 6. And just before I came over here, I read the page proofs for our first issue of volume 7, January 1981.
Well, I think that's terrific. Now, you work with an editorial committee. How does that committee function?
The committee, called the Editorial Committee of the Concordia Journal, is a faculty committee. There are 6 members. 3 members are appointed by the president. 3 members are elected by the faculty. The committee meets once per month. When manuscripts from our colleagues or from other people in our Missouri Synod or Church in general are submitted, copies are made on the Xerox machine, distributed to the 6 members. They read them very carefully, and then the committee as a whole meets once a month to discuss these manuscripts. Mm-hmm. Of course, the answers, the decisions may be 1 of 3, either yes, accept it, no, reject it, or 3, send it back for reworking.
Now, not all articles are written by faculty members, though, are they?
No, we do not limit it to faculty mm-hmm. members. Any pastor, and many of them have done so, have sent in articles, and they have appeared. In fact, we try to aim for a variety of articles.
Mm-hmm. Could you give us some sort of sampling of the kinds of articles that appear in the journal? Are they all very scholarly?
No, not at all. That's what I meant by we try to aim for variety. We have some shorter articles we call editorials. Occasionally, I write an introductory editorial. Then my colleague, Dr. Charlemagne, has a column along the horizon, which appears in each issue. Then the major articles could be very, very scholarly in the area of exegesis or historical theology or systematic theology. But also, another colleague, like Professor Rosso, writes very practical articles on preaching.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to these articles and editorials, we run each month what we call homiletical helps, about a column to a page attempting to assist pastors in sermonizing, giving them sermon outlines. Mm-hmm. And then finally, we do run anywhere from 3 to 8 pages of book reviews.
Mm-hmm. Am I correct that all the pastors receive the journal?
Yes. When I was asked to take over as chairman of the department in 1976, we had a subscription list of between 1,700 and 1,800. This now is finishing the second year in which our Board of Control has graciously agreed to send the journal free of charge to all the clergy of the Missouri Synod in the United States. Currently, we have 8,500 copies printed and mailed every other month.
Uh-huh. Well, if there happened to be any in our listening audience who would like to subscribe to the journal, what would they do?
Just notify our office, send a notice to the Concordia Journal at Concordia Seminary at 801 DeMunn Avenue. Currently, the subscription rate for people living in the United States is $8 per year. For those in Canada, $9 per year. And for foreign subscribers, because of the high cost of postage, $12 per year.
Uh-huh. I see that our time is moving rather rapidly. I did want to ask you about another area of your responsibility, namely, you're listed as a professor of exegetical theology and chairman of that department, which you have served in that capacity since 1976. Now, you explained before a little bit the term exegetical. Would you run that by again and tell us something?
It's merely a Greek word which means exposition or interpretation. And of course, we use it for the exposition or interpretation of a passage of Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
Since our Bible is written in the Hebrew in the Old Testament and in the Greek language in the New Testament. Therefore, on the basis of these original languages, we study the vocabulary, that is the individual words, the grammatical structure, figures of speech, and idioms, mm-hmm. plus, of course, any historical information. So the exegesis is basically dealing with the original text in the original language, mm-hmm. And attempting to translate and interpret these passages for our congregations.
Uh-huh. Now, I understand that you use a very unique method of teaching Greek in your classes. Could you tell us something about that?
Yes. The main thing is that I regard Greek as a living language, not a dead language, simply because there are a lot of people over in Greece today in Athens speaking the language. When mm-hmm. you and I or any individual learned the native language, we learned it completely through the ear. Mm-hmm. We could read English, we could speak English,
mm-hmm.
we could understand English, although we couldn't read it, but mm-hmm. we learned it through our ear. Therefore, when I have a beginning Greek class, I emphasize the oral approach, having them learn it by the ear as well as by the eye.
Is that right?
So after reading a sentence, I have the students close their books, and then I read it aloud, and they get it through the ear, so it becomes a living language. They're learning it just as they would their native language.
I find that extremely interesting. Does this make it easier for the students? I would think so.
I would say it makes it twice as easy, since they're using the ear as well as the eye.
Yeah.
It's twice as much fun, and it's
yeah.
six twice as long.
Right, I would think so. Well, we still have one more area here for you, Dr. Herber, and that's faculty marshal. What in the world does he do, and why does the faculty need a marshal? That sounds a little foreboding to me.
Well, it's sort of like, you might say, a policeman at official assemblies. We have official assemblies in which the faculty must process for the various services. One is at the opening service in September. The faculty dresses out in their robes, hoods, and so forth. Then in around December 9th for Founders Day, in April for Call Day, and in May for Commencement Day. So my job as marshal is, you want to say, threefold. To see that the faculty and the chancellor party get into the chapel in proper order, that they're being seated at the proper place, and then that they recess in the proper order.
Yeah, and in addition to that, it's kind of being in charge of the whole event.
A lot of nuts and bolts. Of course,
right.
I have a lot of help from my colleagues on the faculty.
Yeah. I'm going to backtrack just for a moment
mm-hmm.
here. You were at Westminster for so many years, 27 to be exact.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel after having served here for 7 years now in comparison to having served there for 27 years? Would you like to make any comment on that?
Yes, I guess I came here not because I was looking for another position. I was very, very well satisfied where I was. I came here for one word, and that is need. I felt I was needed here, and after being here for almost 7 years, I must say that I'm positive that I made the right decision. There is so much to be thankful for here, not merely the numerical increase in student body, but it's the general attitude. When I compare the students today with the students when I was here at the seminary, I find that their sincerity, their responsibility is just out of this world. They may not all come here with the same background which we had in our day in the languages. We had to have 6 years of German, 6 years of Latin, 4 years of Greek, and 3 years of Hebrew before anyone would look at our transcript.
Mm-hmm.
They may be short in those areas, but they make it up, and that's one of my jobs here, to try to help them learn the Greek.
Mm-hmm.
But the sincerity of these people who come from outside the system is remarkable, and I must say that each day I'm grateful to our Savior for giving me the opportunity to come here and serve Him at Concordia Seminary.
Well, Dr. Herber, I know that I speak for all of us that Concordia Seminary is really very fortunate to have you on its faculty. You have been and continue to be a real blessing to the seminary. And today we're particularly grateful that you took the time out from your busy schedule to be with us on this first program for 1981 and giving us the opportunity to get to know you a little better and learning about some of the important aspects and programs for which you have responsibility. Thank you so much.
Thank you.